Well, welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. We're glad that you've chosen to come and exercise your mind as opposed to just your body in this beautiful weather today. Maybe it is cooler in here, though, so we are glad you're here. As we begin, let's bow our heads, and Dr. Peter Wong is going to offer a word of prayer.
Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the many blessings you have given us. Even on a day like this, we thankful for the sunshine outdoor and for the comfort in here. And we pray that what we hear today will be a blessing to each one of us individually and also as a community. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Well, we won't spend a lot of time on announcements. You can all read the upcoming events. One thing I would mention is the email sign-up list in the back. If you aren't on the list and would like to get email reminders of the meetings, why, feel free to put your information down there. We have had a number of emails that bounce back as undeliverable, so if you think you're on the list and you're not getting the notifications, why, put down your current information again there, and we'll funnel you back into the system and hopefully get past whatever quirks there are. Well, our program today, as you all know, is by Dr. Alan Handysides, who is in charge of health ministries at the General Conference. He is speaking to us about the topic that he probably knows more about than anybody else on the face of the earth knows, challenges to Adventist missions. And in our current situation of AIDS and other challenges. Dr. Handysides has had a career both in academic medicine, private practice, mission medicine, church administrative medicine, I guess would be the term. And so he is, as I say, probably the person who is better qualified than anybody else around to talk to us about our subject today. And so we welcome you and turn the time over to you.
It's a pleasure, really, to be here with you. I'm disobeying my wife because I said, "Do you think we need to wear a jacket?" And she said, "I think I would." So I very, very properly brought a jacket, but it's on the chair because I just didn't feel as comfortable in a jacket as I do without one. It's nice to see some faces that are very familiar, and I'm pleased to be here and know that there are people that I know and who know me. It's also nice to see faces that I don't know, because it means I'm meeting new people with an ever-widening circle of friends. I'm always reminded when I first went and did my first cesarean section at the Branson Hospital. I'd done lots of cesarean sections, but this was my first one all alone. You know, the residents do them all with somebody watching, but when you do the first one, you're just a little uneasy, and I happened to say, I said, "You know, this is the first time I'm ever doing a cesarean section with nobody looking over my shoulder to support me." And the anesthesiologist, he said to me, "It doesn't matter, Alan. You know we're all friends here." And it's a wonderful thing being an Adventist that everywhere we go, we are all friends. Or we may disagree on some things. I mean, that's a sign of intellectual identity of ourselves, that we can disagree on things. But we are all friends in the Adventist circle, because we're all children of God, we're all brothers and sisters. I thought that I would begin to talk to you a little bit by reminding you that this year is the 100th anniversary of health ministries at the General Conference. That's an important milestone, 100 years. In 1905, they set up the medical, as it was then called, the medical department at the General Conference. A.G. Daniels was the president of the General Conference at that time. It's also the 100th anniversary of Loma Linda University. 100 years since Loma Linda University was established and the medical center which has grown out of that work. So this is a very important year, a year for rejoicing. But it's also a time when we can look back at the work of medical missions to see the work that has been accomplished and then hopefully look forward in the work that must yet be done. I was looking at a list of hospitals and clinics that the church operates around the world, and we had them listed in a temporal order, the order in which they were initiated. We looked at the first 25. It was amazing. St. Helena, I think, was the first official organization that we set up in a medical work. But I go through that list and I see Penang is among the first 25 out there in Malaysia. Sydney Adventist Sanitarium, as it used to be called, was also established among the first 25. Many hospitals here in North America were established as well. We listed about 11 of them that were established. I was interested to see that Kanye Hospital in Botswana was one of the early ones. And so was Malamula Hospital in Malawi. In other words, Adventists, for a long time, have been doing medical work abroad. Usually these hospitals came because of the devotion to duty, the commitment to mission, the dedication of individuals and their families. Sometimes we remember the names of the men and we forget the wives and the children who were so important in the establishment of our work, be it medical work, in our schools, or whatever it was. Sometimes we just remember J.N. Andrews, but what about his wife? What about the family? What about the mother and the father who saw? You know, it would be nice if we knew a bit more about the context of the people that went out there. Consequently, our mission hospitals grew a little bit like Topsy in Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, when she was asked where she came from, she said, "I just growed," you know. And so did our work, it just growed. For instance, if I went to Yucca Hospital, as I did 20 years ago, when I was the medical director for the Trans-Africa Division and then the Eastern Africa Division, as it became called, we had to drive from Lusaka 600 kilometers across very bumpy roads through a game park. And one night we were traveling through there, we actually hit some kind of animal that we dragged into the car, and I remember the young ADRA director that was with me. He was going to put it in his refrigerator and get it, stuffed so he could have it on his wall. I still to this day am not quite sure what kind of animal it was. It had some ring-tailed on it, but I mean, we drive like that 600 kilometers, and we would come to a little tiny place, called Mongu. And you'd sort of stay there for overnight in a flea-ridden hotel. My son came with me one time, and I remember there wasn't a bed in the room for him, so we had his sleeping bag. And I said, "Just a minute, Rob, before you go to bed, I just would like to spray around." So I sprayed around, with some insecticide. And the next morning, I saw these cockroaches, maybe a dozen of them, on their backs. So they were doing this particular dance that they do with their, when they're sort of intoxicated with the, the neurotoxins of those sprays, and they dance like this. No wonder I didn't dance like that myself, because sometimes I used to spray my bed for the bed bugs. And then we would get into a little boat. We had an engine on our boat, and it would take 7 hours of going through a maze of little waterways. And finally, we come to this little place called Calabo and get off there and drive another 10 miles and finally come to Yucca Hospital. And I can remember saying, "Who found this place to establish a mission hospital?" I mean, how could we possibly have a mission hospital so far away from everything? And in those days, it didn't have electricity. You had these donkey boilers where you'd sort of light a fire under the drum and get hot water to have a shower. And the Africans thought you were really spoilt, that you had such a setup that you could actually have a hot water to shower in. And of course, we couldn't complain because we were living luxuriously. But that's how our mission hospitals grew, really without a plan. You know, as a worker got older, as the clinic, which had now grown to a bigger dispensary and a few beds, became known as a hospital, it was given to the church. In those days, the church provided budgets, lots of budgets, for missionaries to go overseas. And so we would usually have in mission hospitals, 25 years ago even, we would have four, five budgets that were provided for expatriates to be working in the hospitals. Of course, we always used to say as missionaries, our job was to work ourselves out of a job. Sounds good, doesn't it? That's the role. You've got to work yourself out of a job. We are here as pioneer missionaries to establish the work, but the purpose is to replace ourselves with indigenous national peoples. And of course, as the church grew, and I will speak very, very plainly today, as the church grew, there was a strong core of ministerial workers that were developed. So our pastors were receiving excellent training in theology, excellent training in pastoral ministries. And so gradually the administration was handed over to people of talent in the local communities. As they did so, though, the General Conference was gradually taking away those budgets and leaving only the local portion for the work. So the appropriation was reduced. It was a good job, too, because while this was going on, here in the homeland, mission giving was in decline. Today, our mission offerings are probably the same as they were in the 60s. So really, if the budgets hadn't declined, the church might have gone bankrupt, I suppose, trying to pay them. Well, I don't think so, because the Lord wouldn't have allowed that to happen. But you see some of the problem. What happened was that as we said to the world church, you must take on the mantle of administration, you can take on the mantle of governance, we in the homelands, in North America, and in the original foci from which missionaries went, began to change our patterns of giving. Now, sometimes the missionaries in the institutions, they began to feel a little of the winds of change. And they didn't always like it. It's very nice to be a big white father, to go into a mission place and to take it under your wing, and with your expertise and your knowledge and your superior trainings and skill, impose your Western outlook on the institution. And see it go from a deficit on the budget line that's deeply in the red, like Maluti was when I went there, you know, 50% of their gross annual income in debt for a year. That's kind of a deficit. That's a big deficit. It would be like Loma Linda being in deficit to the tune, Loma Linda Medical Center being in the deficit to the tune of $300 million, say. Of course, it wasn't $300 million. It was only $150,000. But it's a lot in an African context. And to turn that around, you know, as we did with our, I had an excellent business manager, but to turn it around in the space of 2 years, wow, that seems like a wonderful achievement. But it was achieved with a fair amount of iron-fistedness. And I may, you know, in my older age, look like a genial old man, but I think that I was probably maybe not as genial as I should have been, because I was focused on turning it around. And I never know whether the student nurses who were told that they couldn't have running hot water till it ran cold, they now had to have a bucket full of hot water to have their showers because we were saving money on electricity, whether they really will actually appreciate the name of Dr. Handysides, you know, who would be associated with those stringent cost-cutting measures. But church being what it was, they were pleased. Of course, they moved me to the division. Wow, If you can do that in one hospital. You know, now when I went there, the union was owed $20,000, which in those days was a lot of money, by our little hospital. When I left, why, the union owed us at the hospital $20,000. That was pretty good, you see. And whereas we had spent all our trust funds, now the trust funds were all full up. Whereas we'd had old broken down vehicles, we'd gotten rid of the old vehicles, and we now had new ambulances. Of course, everybody was marching one, two, to Handyside's and Lopsch's dictates. Well, Handyside's goes back home. Lopsch goes back home. Burnham goes back home. Hain goes back home. Ashley's go back home. You know what I'm saying? Over the last 25 years, there has been this exodus of missionaries. And some of them felt kind of pushed out. They felt eased out, edged out. And when they came back home, they didn't always tell the nicest stories about the mission. Maybe they were saying, you didn't get a lot of gratitude in the mission, you know. They weren't very appreciative of our sacrifice. And in the missions they were saying, a very autocratic guy, that Handysides. They were a bit tough, those missionaries. That's why we have a mission institute, trying to somehow break down these problems. You see, we do have a world church. One of the strategic goals of the General Conference is unity. That may be one of the strategic goals, but it is really not one of the mission statements of the church. The statement of the church is to preach, to teach, and to heal. You go around the hospitals today, particularly in Africa, you find that they really reflect the skill of the individual in charge of that hospital. They are owned by local unions. Sometimes there's a lot of nepotism that is playing a role in these hospitals. Sometimes you are absolutely amazed at how much can be done on the shoestrings on which they operate. Sometimes you can go, and like some of the visitors have said, why does the General Conference not close this hospital? It's a disgrace. And yet the hospital is not owned by the General Conference. The hospital is owned by the local union. And the hospital, although we may think in North American terms it's a disgrace, it is still perhaps the only place of treatment that a person may turn to. And it is perhaps the only place where they may receive medicines, however simple, even if it's only a Tylenol or an aspirin, to relieve the pain. So I'm not painting for you a very beautiful nor wonderful picture. And people say, why doesn't the church do something about it? They ask me that. Why doesn't the church do something about it? And I say, who's the church? Because there has been a change in our corporate giving, in our mission giving. We prefer to go on an evangelistic crusade with our brand new Dell computer, which cost us $2,000, and our briefcase, and our ticket, which was another $2,000, and another $2,000, which we put for our costs to stay in the hotels en route, and of course we're going to take in an African safari on the side. And so we prefer to spend our $6,000 and to take it under our arm and to go to mission lands and to proclaim the gospel and to come home and say, We participated in evangelism. It's very important. But we don't very often put $6,000 into the medical mission program of the church or any other program of the church. I suppose it's human nature to count the cost differently if we're involved or not. And it's a dilemma, quite frankly. It's a dilemma to know what is the best, because yes, it's good, but the age of mission seems to be changing, and I hope that we're not just perceived as tourist missionaries who are going to places just to really have a holiday and do some mission work on the side and solve our conscience for the spending of the money because we're doing it for mission work. It's a dilemma. I'm speaking very, very openly, very plainly. You can go to Malamula Hospital. When Gil Burnham was there, he had networks in North America. He still does. Gil Burnham is now full professor, public health, Johns Hopkins University. He has a budget, $7, $8, $9, $10 million every year. He's working in Afghanistan. He's working in all those Turkmenistans, all those Kyrgyzstans, the names I can't say the stands of, you know, they're so strange to spell and everything, but he's got work there for Johns Hopkins. He's still doing it, and he's still got the connections, and he gets USAID money, and he gets, you see, he used to be doing that in the mission hospital at Malamula. He got about $9 million worth of funds went into Malamula Hospital over the 12 to 15 years that he was there. So we've got beautiful auditoriums like this, and brand new wards were built, and even had intravenous fluids set up. But when Gil goes, the network is lost. The networking is lost. So what is the church to do? It's very difficult to know what the church is to do. Our organizational structure is a great advantage and a great disadvantage. Our organizational structure means that the local churches do have control of the work. That's the way it should be. But it has also meant that the places where the money is sometimes feel alienated from those places. And so the flow is not as liberal as it used to be. I think perhaps one of the biggest challenges facing the World Church of Medical Missions is to provide capacity, local and national capacity. The second big need is to be able to employ that capacity. Church policy is difficult. We have wage scales and percentages. I confess with embarrassment that I am probably the highest paid individual at the General Conference. Why do I confess it with embarrassment? Because I look at the president, and I look at the vice presidents and the responsibilities resting on their shoulders, and I think that I don't have as heavy responsibilities. But the church policy says I'm a medical doctor, and therefore I am paid at a different scale. And when I said to them, I don't really want to take an increase because I feel embarrassed by this, and they said, that's what policy says. You have to take it. What you do with the money is your own business. That's one end of the scale, where, having been in practice, I have set aside a little bit of money for retirement, where I don't feel particularly worried about my future. I mean, I'm not going to retire like a millionaire that I am, like you think a millionaire will retire. That's not how I'm going to retire. But at the same time, when I think of our national doctors in Africa, I look at the salaries they want to pay them. Sure, it's more than the union president, maybe. But it means he can't educate his children to the level to which he's been educated himself. And you see, to be a doctor there is an emancipation from years of poverty and of being subjugated. Imagine, you're a bright kid. You win a scholarship. And you go to university. And you choose the longest course you can because you might as well get your money's worth. It happens to be medicine. So you go through and you're a doctor. And you find you've got enough money to educate your kids. And your kids are not quite as bright as you were. Just a shake of the genetic dice. But they're bright. Oh yes, they're bright. They're not just quite bright enough. They're not winning the scholarships. They've got the ability to do the courses, but not to get the scholarships. If you go on a church salary, you won't be able to pay the fees. So you say, I can't work for the church. Charity begins at home. I've got 3 kids, 4 kids. They've got to be educated because God blessed me. I got out of my rut of poverty. I don't want my children to have to be like, I want to educate them because education is the emancipation. So he doesn't want to work for the church. And pious saints in the homeland say, where's the sense of sacrifice? But they won't work on a church salary. We did. I did. We were willing to go as missionaries. Big questions. So we've got a lot of things that we need to look at. With this in mind, we've approached some of our division executives, and we are putting a gentle pressure. Gentle pressure, can you not hear me? Okay. We're putting gentle pressure. A gentle kind of pressure that's a more mellowed type of pressure that I used to put at Maluti. That they should look at their hospitals and look at the way they're doing things. 2 of our divisions in Africa have decided to go to a system. Philippines and SSD, South Asia Pacific, going to a system. India has a kind of system. And we will be encouraging them to devise ways and means nationally, locally, that they can create policies. That they will set up a central board of governance that determines maybe to look at the wage scales and the wage protocols. Maybe there can be some system of fee for service, percentage incentive work. Maybe we can look at some of our clinics and franchise them out. You know, everywhere you go in the world, you see the golden arches. It amazes me that you can sell hamburgers and greasy fries all around the world and make millions of dollars. And that Adventists, with the Adventist health message that we have, seem to have a problem in branding our work. What if we were to franchise out an Adventist health system and get national doctors to practice under the banner not of the Golden Arches, but Adventist Health Services. I don't care if they drive in a Mercedes or a Lada. Doesn't make any difference to me. I don't think it makes any difference to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ as long as they are witnessing. Witnessing in love and in kindness. So we are working very closely. But you know, the church is like a great ship. When I was going out to Africa with my wife and 2 little children, we didn't have our 3rd, She was worried. She looked at the ship and she said, they've only got three ropes going around these decks. What's to prevent the children falling overboard? And the captain said, you've got to do that, ma'am. You have to keep your eye and look after your children. She said, yes, but what happens if one falls overboard? He says, well, if we can see him, we'll turn the ship around. She said, how long does it take to turn around? He says, about a mile. That's how it is with the church. We are a very big organization. It takes a long time to move the church, but we are moving in that direction. I then want to mention just a little bit about AIDS. As you know, we are here because we have an AIDS conference called Call to Compassion. We originally thought we'd have a big pre-session meeting on HIV/AIDS, and so they sent a survey out to find out how many people would be interested in coming to a conference on HIV/AIDS. And 80% of the responses said they would not be interested in coming to a conference on HIV/AIDS. Now, that's not because they're bad people. It's because they just don't understand the enormity of the problem. They think it's homosexuals that have HIV/AIDS. They think it's related to the steamy bathhouses in San Francisco, because we're still stuck in a 25-year time warp. They don't realize that HIV/AIDS has become such an epidemic that 45%, 42% of the population of Swaziland is infected. 42% of the population of Botswana is infected. Well, let me give you the statistics. In 1990, it was 0.9% of the South African female population attending prenatal clinics was infected. By 1994, it was 7.9%. That's the year Mandela came to power. And by 1998, it was 22%. And it's climbing up to around 27% of people going in having their babies are infected with HIV/AIDS. And it's not just in the community, it's in the church. And our church is a young church, and the group that's affected are 16 to 35-year-olds. And while this epidemic is going on, you know, just like in health ministries, we may be arguing about milk and cheese. In the AIDS epidemic, we're arguing about whether a condom, you know, or not a condom. And we get distracted. And while all the arguments are going on, compassion flies out the window. And our hospitals, when they do testing, we find that up to 75% of the people lying in our hospital beds are infected with HIV/AIDS. And when you go to the pharmacies, they're empty shelves, and we don't have any medicine. And when you go to the churches, they act like they're Pharisees. If somebody walks in and's got HIV/AIDS, everybody says the first question they ask is, how did you catch it? Of course, just think, if your pastor told you he was HIV/AIDS or he had HIV virus infection, what would you say? Come on, your first question would be, how did the pastor contract it, right? Jesus didn't ask that. When he saw the blind man and the disciples say, who sinned? Who sinned? This man or his parents? There was no doubt about the sin. They knew about that. I mean, he's got the stigma. He's blind. But who sinned? This man or his parents? To be Christ-like, we don't ask that question. We say, this man is blind, and that being the case, it's an opportunity for me to demonstrate the glory of God. This HIV/AIDS epidemic is not an opportunity for us to dissect the cause
or the morality, or who's wrong, or who isn't, but to demonstrate the glory of God. And the glory of God has been no better demonstrated than in the person of Jesus Christ, who left heaven and became a missionary. And he came to this world and he did his very best. And then he went back to heaven. And he left his disciples, the indigenous workers, to carry on the ministry. We are the indigenous workers in this world, entrusted with the missionary work of preaching, of teaching, and of healing. Now, you know, when I come to a forum, I have a few questions in my mind. You think, is this going to be a cantankerous bunch? Are they going to flay me alive? Are they going to pick up on every little word I said and dissect my sentences and see if my sentence construction could be put into a different meaning? That's the problem of image that Adventist forums struggle with. Just as we, working for the church, who, by the way, are no different from you who are also working for the church, except we're doing it full-time and paid for it, and you're doing your own remuneration, which I used to do, so we've been on both sides of the street. We have to understand that these stereotypes are sometimes a result of prejudice and of stigmatization, even within ourselves. And so I haven't come here and given you a very erudite message. I've wanted to give you the message that Adventist mission today is in transition. Transition from the days of where we did it all and got all the glory, to the point where, like Jesus, we have to share our mission with others. And we have to rejoice in their success. We have to realize that we are one world team. We're not North American division and South American division. We are all part of one world church. And our mission is the same. And the mess that we've gotten ourselves into is because of compartmentalization, of the building of walls and of barriers. But you know, walls can come down. Just look at the Berlin Wall. Barriers can be blown away. I just am praying that we will all catch a new vision. Those in the mission lands, and some of you are there, will realize that there is help and support that can still come from those lands that used to send their missionaries. And those mission lands that used to send missionaries can realize that we still have a role to play, even if it is in the role of capacitance and capacity building. I look at Dr. Zirkel, who to me embodies Loma Linda University. When I look at him, I always think, Loma Linda. The work that institutions like Loma Linda and Andrews University are doing in capacity building is perhaps the new frontier of mission. We have an enormous work to create structures and systems, but then we have to educate, train the people in those systems so that they can raise the mission work. Loma Linda has a wonderful program. If an institution overseas thinks that they have a need to get somebody with a doctorate to train at a higher level of education. Loma Linda will offer free tuition as long as that individual is signed up and has a contract to go back and work for at least 5 years in the institution that has pled for this particular scholarship to be given. Loma Linda has trained countless numbers of healthcare workers. What Loma Linda has done in health, Andrews has done in ministry. This is our role. Our role is not to dictate and say, this is how your mission should be in your country, but it's to say, let's join together with you and empower you. Because as we empower them, we ourselves are empowered. I think I've talked enough. I probably can answer some questions for you, and this is where it might get tricky, but I'll lay myself open to answer some questions if you have them.
Since coming back, I've tried to continue meddling a little bit and have a question about the pay scales. I founded an organization that took one of those promising young people, sent them to Montemorelos, and got them through medical school. The wage scale was such that, since it's based on local conditions, and Sierra Leone was one of the poorest, the wage scale was such that a local doctor would make about $400 a month. So that illustrates the problem you were describing. Mm-hmm. This student is not eager to go back. And even if he takes out Mexican citizenship, which he's doing now so that he can go to a residency, the local division decides whether to treat him as an expatriate or as a local. And from other experiences I've heard about, the local divisions refuse to accept them as expatriates. So there's the problem of how to support him when he goes back. And there are huge differences between even countries within West Africa. Sierra Leone being on the bottom of the heap, pastors were being paid a little over $100 a month when I was there. In neighboring Togo, it was $800 a month because they were under the French monetary system. Is there any solution in sight to something like this? Because when we train students, and I've been involved in the training of more than 10, and one or two have gone back because of problems like this.
The problems are really very difficult. I've been on both sides as you have, and you understand how difficult it is. Part of the problem is historic and grew out of the way we paid missionaries. Some of the missionaries were on different pay scales from the nationals. The nationals looked at these expatriate scales. There was a lot of unease and jealousy maybe went on because of that. It's very difficult. The first thing I would say is we can't look and say he's paid $400 from North America. Because as you said, the pastor over there gets 100. So he's getting four times the pay of a pastor. The part of the problem is when you bring somebody to the land of plenty, it's the cruelest thing you can do. And say, now you've got to go back to Washington, to D.C. That's what we're doing when we bring them here sometimes. So there's a problem there. So I think that problem needs to be addressed by us developing medical schools and training opportunities in developing countries where we can train them and yet not give expectations that would spoil their ability to work in their homelands. We then say, well, why can't they be looked upon as North Americans? Which is part of the question. There's been a lot of agonizing over that, and the policies are changing. If a person takes up North American citizenship and is called from North America with a U.S. passport, he will be granted the ability to be paid as an expatriate. That means he will be paid the same $400
in Sierra Leone as he would get. But there would be a homeland deposit placed here to take care of his needs here in North America for his household and commitments in North America. That's what that purpose was. But of course, to somebody who really is going to live over there, that is like a very, very good bonus that he's got back in the homeland. It's difficult. I don't know what the solution is. I don't think this forum or conferences of the General Conference executive are ever going to be able to resolve these things adequately. There are gross disparities around the world. Maybe the world Trade Organization is going to do that. Maybe in the States, eventually, we are going to find that we have to work for $2 an hour as well, otherwise our job's gone to China. I don't know. You know, we are in a time of great turmoil, and globalization is something that is extremely difficult. I do think that we need to move to a situation where we release some of the tight church policies, so that there can be a true reflection of the local economy in proportion to the type of work that's being done. Although that doesn't always work. For instance, some of the Solomon Islands, I said, well, why don't you let them do that? And they said, well, that would be less than the church pays, you know? So it's a very difficult situation. But we in health ministries are aware of it. I believe many people in administration are aware of it. And in those two divisions that I mentioned, well, the four divisions that I mentioned, they have systems. There is starting to be possibilities. Sierra Leone is one division that hasn't done anything about it. And there again, we're dependent upon the leadership and the vision of the leadership in those local situations as to whether things will change or not. I didn't answer your question, I know, but I understand.
There's a lot of money being raised for various ministries of the church. And we hear about those all the time and we give to them, but I never hear anything about what happens to the money that's raised when you put on the tithe envelope, world budget, so much. Can you give us a picture of how that money is allocated?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not in stewardship, so I can't tell you exactly how those funds are divided up. But when we talk about a mission giving, let me give you an example. We have 169 hospitals. We have maybe 300 and some clinics. We have over 500 institutions throughout the world. And we are giving to those, we have what we call the IDE, International Denomination Employees, Interdivisional Employees. We provide budgets for them, and that comes out of those types of offerings. That's not a very glamorous, it's not a very glamorous offering, you see. But without that offering, all of our medical work would collapse. Because that's what provides for the Dr. James Appel that is working in Chad, which some of you may have heard about. That's what provides for every expatriate or interdivision employee comes out of that pot in every hospital. If those budgets disappear, our hospitals and our medical work, quite honestly, will just implode. There will be no medical mission work. But it isn't very glamorous to give. It's going towards the same sort of thing as tithe. You know, tithe seems like it's a black hole. It doesn't have banners, you know. It's hard to sort of say, our pastor, you know, and put a big banner about the pastor like you can for an evangelistic campaign or a new roof on a building someplace or palm trees and young people building something. It doesn't have the appeal of the individual project, but it is the nuts and bolts and the daily grind of mission work that is being supported through those kind of offerings. And that means 2,000 deliveries at Maludi Hospital. It means 800 surgeries at Maludi Hospital. It means 400 orphan children, head of household, children who are head of household receiving sufficient food to feed them. It means that we have an ambulance there that can go out to 11 clinics and see maybe 600 patients out in the bush every week, and it means that we can treat some mothers and prevent transmission of HIV/AIDS to them. It means that children with diarrhea get treated and lives are saved. It's an enormous work that is being done, just say, at Maluti Adventist Hospital, which can be repeated at Malamulu and Kanye and Yuka and Heri and Mugunero and Gimbi. And, you know, you can just go on and on with this work. But we don't have a James Appel sending out a weekly email to hundreds of people in every one of these institutions. So it kind of ceases to be glamorous, and not everybody has the ability of James to write. I mean, if we did, we'd soon get sensory overload, just like when you see another sort of, it used to be the Biafrans or another AIDS victim, you see another hungry, emaciated child, you just turn the page instead of turning your stomach.
I don't know where to begin. I'll just reduce my remarks to one area. Thank you for mentioning Yuka. My daughter was born there. Mm-hmm. Three missionaries' children there, in the days of Fred Thomas and Kunrad Birkenstock, yes, yes, and Raymond Tarr. Yeah. In any case, a couple of years ago, I was at an African missionaries meeting, and I don't recall his name. I didn't come prepared for this. The medical director at Loma Linda,
Dick Hart.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He mentioned
he's the chancellor of the university.
Yeah, the chancellor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned, having had experience in Africa and elsewhere, that the real problem with sophisticated medical institutions in third world countries, I want to see if you agree with this, is not so much, I mean, this is a tremendous problem, the problem of paying the doctor.
Yeah.
But doctors can be trained, but he says the infrastructures and the management and the degradation of the physical plants of many of our third world hospitals is where the problem has come since there's been an exodus of so-called expatriate workers. Can you address that?
This is a major problem.
And that's true at Yuka, for example, right now.
I would agree. We agree with them, with you on this. And Dick and I know that this is the fact. When we talk about it being a problem of management, to a large degree, it is a problem of management. But we are not going to resolve the problem of management by sending a new wave of neo-missionaries. Because
we have to pay them at least the rates of the going rate in that particular country.
Yes, but if we were to send a bunch of Americans over there again, that will not solve the problem. That can be a stopgap measure to rescue a floundering institution, to staff it with four or five capable people to bring it around. But that's not the problem. The problem is, when we say developing, we really mean the lack of skills. Because if they were developed, they wouldn't be developing. And when it comes to ministerial, they are now, we have them developed. Our pastors over there are as good a theologians and good a preachers and kept. But when it comes to administration, we don't have the administration. Their doctors are good. But we don't have the administrators. We don't have the people who can look at a situation and, from a business perspective, know what to do with it. That is part of the problem. A second problem is a cultural problem. A hospital is a westernized concept. We have to accept that. It's a westernized concept. When Albert Schweitzer went out to Africa, if you see pictures of his hospital, it was appalling. Because he wanted to contextualize it. We've never done that. We take our hospitals and we want them to be reflections of our westernized hospitals. We do need to contextualize. But we have to recognize that we cannot put up with, if it's going to be a successful operation, we cannot put up with poor sanitation, we cannot put in with leaky roofs, and we need to keep the buildings, we need a state of repair. There is a major, major deficit there. I'm not sure whether even good management for 5 years will correct that. I mean, when Gil Burnham was there, he was a good manager, so the place looked spifflicating. When we left Maluti, looked pretty nice. When Jack Hain left Mwami, good stuff. Other hospitals where you had a good doctor, but he didn't have those administrative capacities, they may not do the same. And so what we are seeing is a group of institutions that lack that. Now, another problem with the church is this. We get a national who has promise. So we say, wow, this is a great guy. So we train him. We send him, he gets an MBA. He's doing fantastic, like in Blantyre. I mean, I'm not holding back on you guys here. Doing really well. The union says, aha, he's a great administrator. We need him for the union. So they take him and put him in the union. And back, the institution now has lost the administrator. We have to get it through into the heads of our leadership in developing countries that the medical institutions are a little different. And when we've got somebody that's good, leave him there, because they need good people in the medical institutions. That's why we want a system. We want a system for many reasons. Number one, we want to get all these budgets and get a clamp on them that they stop whittling them away. And when you're without a budget there for a year, they say, oh, you don't need that budget. You've done without it for a year, so they take it away. That's strategy. So we want to stop that because it becomes part of the system's budget. The second thing is we want to be able to say, all right, we've got a system, now we're going to train people within our system. Secondly, we probably want to pay them more so that when they get an offer to go to the union or the field or the wherever it is, they're going to say, I'm going to stay here in the system. I'm a little better off in the system. We have to do that if we're going to be able to keep these sophisticated administrators. And then on the board, and this is another thing we're lobbying for, is that those boards of governors should have some North American administrators on there. They should have the hospital administrators on that board rather than the union presidents. That there should be maintenance engineers on the board. There should be nurses on the board to write the protocols for all the hospitals that will be applied to all of them rather than expecting each matron or nursing director to come up with the standards, that there will be a universal formulary so that every hospital has the same formulary. Maybe there'll be a uniform purchasing. Maybe they all work through ADRA together. Maybe we stop trying to run it alone, each is an independent thing, and put them together. And maybe when we look at some isolated, far-flung hospital, and I'm not saying Yucca, but you got the idea, and we say, that was 100 years ago, and the population, 90% of it's moved from the rural area into Lusaka, say, we need to put an institution in Lusaka. That decision is not based on the whim of local people who have such an affection and attachment to their local institution that they won't let it go, but that there can be some kind of strategic overall planning to see that our medical work gets the biggest bang for the buck. These are some of the directions we're trying to push.
Hey, I have two questions here, and then I'm going to go over to the other side some people have been raising their hands.
This is Calvin Joshua from Southern Asia Division.
Yes.
Dr. Alan Handyside, I thank you for the presentation. You have touched a number of areas that interest, particularly as a student of mission. The question that I have in this afternoon for you is, India, with 1,100 million people, church existing there for 120 years, what is your vision for medical education so that we will meet the challenges that are in your mind?
First of all, you have to understand that as Health Ministries Director, our role is purely an advisory one. I want to stress that point to you because my opinion is my opinion. And any executive capacity comes through executive committees, not through me. And they may know what I say, but the committee votes. Secondly, in India, that falls under the Southern Asia Division. The division office will dictate what's going to happen in India for the medical world. But what is my vision? What do I see? I think it is very, very important that we, in the next short time period. I don't know what time frame. I don't want to give a time because I'll be quoted as saying that. But we should be giving consideration to the development of a medical school that will serve both Africa, India, and Asia. Amen. Now, a medical school that will serve those territories, I believe, will have to teach in the English language, because that will serve the greater good. The reason that I think it would be good to put it off the continent of Africa is that it will probably serve India and Asia better off the continent of Africa. And yet, I think there are countries, we could put it, that it would serve the needs of Africa within the financial constraints of that continent. I don't want to tell you where I would think such a medical school should be placed, because I would immediately be in a frying pan. And of course, it's not my position to make that decision. But I do think that if there were a medical school that could be established in a situation where the economic costs of operation were not too great, in a situation where we recognized our primary purpose was to perform a nuts and produce a nuts and bolts doctor, we don't need to have proton beams. We don't need to have the highest powers of surgical or medical specialization. But we need to turn out an intern who understands and recognizes pneumonia and heart failure and kidney functions and understands the basic bread and butter of medicine, who puts him in a position that he's quite now capable of specializing and learning at the higher and the tertiary levels of medicine. I think there's a need to do that for Africa. This is why I want the systems, because the systems would then allow us to say, we are designating Malamula Hospital, we have an obstetrician there. That will be our center for obstetrics. We are going to use Kanye, where we have a physician and a cardiologist, as our medical center. We're going to use Maluti for general surgery. We're going to use Muganero for pediatrics. I'm just giving examples. And in that way, we could then take a postgraduate rotating program and rotate them through our different hospitals. They do 6 months of the surgery, 6 months of the... And at the end of that, it would be a very peculiar training they would have received, but it would be mission doctor training. And at the end of 3 years or 4 years, we could say, now you have a medical missionary diploma in this kind of work. I think that this would tend to teach these graduates Adventist mission work in practice. It would give them a good grounding so they could do cesarean sections and even knew how to do circumcision. But I mean, they could do a wide variety of things and be of great value to them and to us. And it would also have the benefit that should there be war break out, because some of these countries are politically very unstable, should war break out in Sierra Leone, and we've been using that hospital, we move our staff over to Ila Ife in Nigeria, and Nigeria now becomes the base for, and if war breaks out there, we move them across to Cameroon. And so we would have the flexibility, not being tied all our eggs in one basket, and being able to move our people around. But you know, to coordinate a work like this and to get this done, quite honestly, it is maybe beyond my capabilities. I have a good team. It may be beyond our team's capabilities, but we believe that the Spirit of the Lord does lead and will lead. And so we are optimistic. And even though people say, how can you stand to work against such inertia, we're prepared to do that because we do believe the Lord is leading His church.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. What you have said just now, that can be made possible because right now Loma Linda University is doing the same work. It is offering Masters in Nursing program,
yes,
in Bangkok, and they have invited all the developing students from all the developing countries, and they're training around 32 nurses for, yes, Masters training. The same type of program can be envisaged also for the medical program, but somewhere in the developing countries, maybe India, maybe one of the countries in Africa. And that will be a great program. And Loma Linda can come forward with that kind of thinking as their contribution to the medical ministry. Mm-hmm. That's what you have said. I have just said a point. But my point to you, my question to you is this. I think one of the reasons why we are failing in the medical ministry, especially in the developing countries, is we are not still able to bifurcate, or we are not able to still decide which hospital is meant for the basic services and which hospital can become a sophisticated multi-specialty hospital. We are still, most of our hospitals, I'm speaking mostly representing the third world countries and the developing countries, there we have started several hospitals. For example, in India, right now we have 12 hospitals.
Yes.
In all the 12 hospitals, we don't have 12 doctors to run those hospitals. If we have one medical doctor who is an Adventist, it's a great hospital. In every one of our hospitals, we have only one family that is running a hospital. So we are not able to contain the doctors, especially because our salary is $50 per month. For a graduate of the non-medical program, it's $18 starting salary. For a medical doctor, $50 a month. So we are unable to contain them. Now, with this great problem, we will have to decide which hospital is going to be giving the basic services and which hospital should be converted as a specialty or the multi-specialized super specialty hospital. Then we will be able to run the hospitals in those areas. Now we are trying to do a hodgepodge work in all the hospitals and no hospital is running good. So it's good to divide, either starting from the highest level. Let's say this is going to be for the basic services. It's going to be in the rural area. It is going to give the basic services and it's going to be evangelical oriented and it's going to help the rural type. But there should be some hospitals in the town which should be sophisticated, and that ought to be done. If not, we will end up nowhere.
I appreciate your comment, and I think that you have hit something. We try to set up general hospitals that will do everything, surgery, deliveries. We need to define what we will do. Some of our most successful hospitals are hospitals that say, we do eye work only. We could set up hospitals that say, we are a maternity unit only. The other problem that you allude to is that our hospitals are being run by non-Adventist doctors. I would ask you and your administration to ask yourself this question. Why do the non-Adventist doctors work for our hospitals, but the Adventist doctors don't? And I would suggest that you give a little thought to the fact that you may be paying the non-Adventist doctors four times more than you are willing to pay the Adventist doctors. Maybe 10 times more. So I would like to ask why you persist in that type of behavior. Just that's for your division to ask that question, because it is clearly ludicrous that you're willing to staff your hospital with non-Adventist doctors at 4 to 10 times, whatever it may be, the salary you're willing to pay to an Adventist physician, because you're tied to the policy. It's time to take the governance of these institutions out of the church manual policies and put it into its own policies, which permits you to pay Adventists what you are already paying non-Adventist doctors.
I'm a registered nurse, and in regard to AIDS, I share your value that we should treat and not ask how people got it. However, the growth of AIDS is fastest among heterosexual women, most of whom are married. And in sub-Saharan Africa, it's associated with female circumcision and with the inability of a woman to have control over her own body and be able to refuse sexual intercourse to anyone, including her husband. With cultural attitudes of pride, for instance, when a husband might die of AIDS, then his brother has a responsibility to take care of the widow. The widow cannot refuse sexual relations with the brother, and that leads to the spread of HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. Is the church doing anything, the church, well, you know, is anything being done as far as treatment to look at these cultural issues that have to do with the rights of women over their own bodies?
Well, I'm sure that you're attending our HIV/AIDS conference, because that is a sensitizing conference to try and face many of these issues. Just to, for purposes of real clarity and what I believe is kind of integrity, female genital mutilation, as we call it here, and female circumcision, as they call it there, although in effect it is clitorectomy in many parts of the world, is really not, is not prevalent in the areas where HIV/AIDS is most prevalent. In other words, when we look at the pattern of distribution of HIV/AIDS, it is in Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, Southern Eastern Africa. Most of the situation of female genital mutilation is up in the northeast around Sudan, parts of the Muslim world. And the Muslim world actually has less HIV/AIDS. So just for purity of talk, let's not mix our things there for fear that we would be picked up on and told that we were not talking, you know, the straight message. It is true, the cultural customs of the leverage system where the brother comes in, even, I hate to say it, but there are some customs whereby they even have intercourse with the dead and so forth. Some of these customs are extremely difficult to battle. That's not what I mean when I say don't ask how they got it. I used to say in my practice, I treat all people, princesses and prostitutes, just the same, to my best of my ability, all of them. And when I say don't ask, we ask in the investigation of the disease, but we don't, at an individual level, attempt to ask those questions, because that is only to embarrass an individual. But we have to ask, for the greater good, these other questions. And of course, if we are going to address the problem, we have to address these cultural issues. And I think that we are making progress. Our pastors, you know, are requiring education, because they say things like, you know, is it all right to wash somebody's feet who's got HIV in the communion service? And what about baptizing an HIV woman if she's menstruating at the time of the baptism and she's HIV positive? These are questions that are not coming from a malicious intent, but are from fear and anxiety of ignorance. There's a lot of questions that we have to raise. We've got a great deal of education, but education alone is not going to be the answer to this problem. The answer to this problem is going to be in the relationships that we build, the relationships of trust and of love that are sufficiently strong that they will be able to believe us and trust us enough to change their behaviors. The fear of change, the distrust of our message will only be overcome when we actually establish bonds with those people. And it's going to take a long time, and it's a challenge to the church. It's a challenge to me as an individual, to you as an individual, to say, you know, it's time to stop talking and it's a time to start doing. And how can I help?
Before I ask my question, I just wanted to touch on the last thing that was said about circumcision. Given the figure that you gave about the ages that have more HIV virus between 16 to 35, I think it makes it probably difficult for me to believe that circumcision will have an effect, because I feel that starting in about 1970, especially at least where I come from, there wasn't much circumcision of women, of girls. They had stopped circumcising girls at that time. So, and then you say that the ages that have much more HIV are 16 to 35, which means that probably circumcision is not having or exposing them more to HIV.
Well, I'll let you continue, but as an epidemiological factor, it probably isn't a major factor because many of these people are Muslim and have strict behavioral codes, much stricter than maybe Christians do and so forth. But the anatomical distortion to the genital tract that occurs with a female circumcision can be very extensive. And women already are at risk 8 times greater than a male for acquiring the infection. So anything that is going to make for more breakage of skin or opening of the skin, such as a circumcision, could lead to that. Of course, we realize that there's a range of circumcision that ranges from a slight pinch of the frenulum of skin away, which probably has no activity at all, to these total and radical and very brutal operations that are performed in totally undesirable circumstances. So I don't think that epidemiologically circumcision has had or played a great role. I could look at far more pervasive historical facts than that have had a role with HIV/AIDS. On the other hand, if a woman is to have intercourse with a male who is infected and she has had a genital disturbance, she's going to be at heightened risk of acquiring the infection. She's already at heightened risk by reason of her normal anatomy. So you add a distortion to that, it's going to increase it. So, you know, there is truth there in what both of you are saying. Now, your question, yes.
I feel that when we started establishing hospitals at different places, we had a vision. And I'm wondering if those hospitals have been allowed to, you know, to fall down or close or been run down, if we have lost the vision that we had. Because the vision I thought was, let's go and make them well so that they can listen to us while we preach. And now we are abandoning those hospitals. Is it that we are no longer interested in having healthy people listen to us while we preach?
That's the question that we ask. Have we lost the vision? And it didn't help us to hear a division president in one of the developing countries one time say, we have not the means to continue the mission hospitals, nor the will to close them down. That was not a very encouraging statement. It's a good question, but I think it's a question that we need to ask in the places where these hospitals are being operated.
Okay, the other question is, you mentioned something about organizational structure. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that also you mentioned something about war. I feel that the walls that are being created are not being built by the people we want to treat or the common people.
No.
It is being built by the organizational structure. So we have to look at the structure that we have, whether it is an impediment to what we want to do or not. And the other thing is, you also mentioned about having Adventist health system, in which wherever we go, whether I'm in India, whether I'm in Taiwan or Jamaica, wherever I am, I can see the sign and it says Adventist system, and I want to, you know, I hope that I'm going to get the same treatment, the same thing. And remember that we have, you mentioned also about McDonald's. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, they have all these places, but those are a structure that even in Coca-Cola, the mixture may be the same, but they are tailored according to whichever country where they are.
Yes.
But they are the same thing, and it is being, you know, it is being done so that the image of Coca-Cola will still be maintained. So are we ready that if we put Adventist health system wherever we go, or in most of the countries where we have Adventism, that we are going to sustain it from wherever the headquarters is and make it retain that name, Adventist Health System?
You got my message perfectly. Yeah.
I'm curious. I've enjoyed listening to your presentation. I know that we've closed down Youngberg Memorial Hospital, downsized it to a clinic, and now it is no longer there in Singapore. I would like to know the lessons that have been learned from this situation, and how I know at Penang Mission Hospital is thriving. Could you tell us anything about the lessons learned from these two settings?
Different people learn different lessons. Penang is doing very, very well. Penang is, I would say, probably the flagship institution of the South Asia Pacific Division. It is thriving because it is using a business model as its basis and doing very, very well on that business model. But a lot of its success resides in the fact that it's in a country that can afford to pay, or there are people who can afford to pay in its vicinity and in its hinterland, can afford to pay for the type of medicine that's being practiced there. I think it comes down to administration and management of our institutions. That's where the question comes. If it is viable to operate a hospital anywhere in the world, then we should be able to operate that institution if we have the right management. So management is the important thing. On the other hand, there are situations where you cannot run a self-sustaining institution. And that's where the church has to make the decision, are we going to run a mission there? We understand what mission means. If they say this is a union mission, it means it gets subsidy. If it's a union conference, it's supporting itself. All right, that's parlance in church terms. So if we're going to run a real mission hospital, it means a subsidized institution. We have to make that decision. Are we going to operate on the model of a business model? It's going to be self-sustaining, self-supporting, which is Penang, which can do very well, which is Loma Linda, which is all our North American hospital. And there are places we can do that in a part of the world. And then there are those mission hospitals. Those are hospitals that are in places where the people don't have two brass farthings to rub together. So how are they ever going to be able to pay for a CT scanner? And then we're going to have to decide what level of care are we going to give to these people. And in North America and Europe and Australian places of the world where we have money, and let's not forget, because there's nothing burns us up as donors more than outstretched hands which do not contain their share. You know, somebody holds up a dollar and says, I got a dollar, but it's going to cost us five. Can anybody help us with that? Sure, you'll get the $4. But when you hold up nothing, people say, yeah, you're just beggars. See? That, by the way, is to me a major, major development that has to take place in developing countries. Wherever the developing country realizes that they are responsible for their own development and they're not looking outside for any donations, they're going to do it themselves. Then you see true development. Wherever there is constantly this, what I call this hands-out attitude, development never takes place. That's welfare. But where they're willing to move ahead, and in certain parts of the world, even on same continents, you will see with certain leaders who have got that vision, sometimes a thing will thrust if they understand that they have to do some development themselves. So lessons learned, I don't know who's supposed to learn the lesson. You know, the committees change every 5 years. You know, I hear them saying, we're going to the general conference. Somebody said in one of the meetings, we're going to the general conference. You know, it's time to vote in a new team of leaders. Well, you know, it takes 5 years to really learn the curve of to how to do it. You know? And then you change them all. That's the way the church works. And then we send, well now, and you say, the lessons learned? Well, they were learned by the previous group, but we don't have them there anymore. So So now they've got to be learned again. You know, we've got to rethink how we do church sometimes. I'm worried about this recording because this gets back to my president. I may be, you know, you may have to teach another guy. Oh, that's right, yes.
Dr. Andesai, my name is Pierre.
Oh, yes.
And I'm so happy that at least one of the leaders of the church can be as bold as enough as yourself to address, to tackle the disparities of the payment between within our church, between our church, you know, workers. And I remembered, I'm so glad I can speak out in this quality because I am a byproduct of the third world and the developed third world countries and the developed countries. And I'm wondering, as Dr. Charles Bradford said once, when I came from Ethiopia, in fact, you know, you know, if I got in Zimbabwe, you were
right
there,
yes.
Gimbi Hospital.
Yes.
And when I came back, Dr. Charles Bradford said, it was a colloquium there, I was invited at GC to present my report, and Elder Charles Bradford said, brethren, I'm going to say it plainly, now I am retired, my future is in the past. And now, since I am retired 2 months ago, even though some of those people don't believe it, they say, oh no, you cannot talk about retirement. I said, now the time has come for me to do what I always want to do for the Lord and to help His cause and with His people. Over 25 years ago, this is not a hard question, and I remember it wasn't, fortunately I was, you know, blessed to work for 4 different divisions. In 1982, you established with us an MSPH program in the Inter-American Division. I'm wondering what has been done with these people who have been, you know, in this program. Have you used them for this type of program throughout the world?
200 people received an MPH program, MPH degree in the Inter-American Division over the duration of that particular time period. 200 people received an MPH. Those men and women are scattered all over the world. Unfortunately, we could only find one of them that was involved in health ministry.
And whenever you pray for this guy, and the administration will be the one to take these people. I remember when I finished from Northern Caribbean University, and I went on my own, but when I came back, and the church supposed to use me for the administration, since I was in the field of business and theology, but the church said, hey, no, we don't want you to be in the school. Adra said, I will take cash, and we get this guy for over 20 years, they kept me with Adra.
Well, we don't think everything is lost, because, you know, if there is a president who's got an MPH, at least he'll have a bias towards health. So we're still promoting MPHs. And the good news is that in this capacity building arena, Loma Linda University School of Public Health is going to commence an MPH program this year in Russia. And they were funded by the donors of this building to run this program. It will be run for the next 4 years. They said, well, we'll train 60. There are already 85 people that have been accepted. There are another 60 or so who would like to get into the program. It's difficult. I wouldn't like to be on the selection committee. But we're going to be training MPHs there in Russia. Now, for those of you who may be from overseas, because I see some of you are from overseas, and you mentioned the Master of Nursing program that Loma Linda is doing around the world. Our registered nurses around the world, many of them do not have degrees. Griggs University has come to the table and you take this back to India. Griggs University has come to the table and said, we will look at the curriculum that has been taught in a registered nursing program, and if it meets our standards, we will give 70 credits. We will look at the midwifery program, and if it meets our standards, we will give 20 credits. So a registered nurse midwife can have 90 credits. They need 120 credits to get a general ed BA. If they've done Bible, as they should be doing at our Adventist college, they need to be teaching a Griggs Bible course, and they then need another 15 hours of Griggs courses. Griggs has come up and said that in developing countries like India and Africa, they will give those credits, and now listen carefully, they'll give those credits for $10 a credit hour. It's unbelievable. So that means for $300 to $500, depending on what they have, they can go and get a Bachelor of Education. But you say, a Bachelor of Education, what's the good of that? The Bachelor of Education is now the entrance key to the MPH, to the Master of Nursing Science, to the MBA. We're in this business of capacity building. If we can get those nurses, they can do then an MBA, which will make them the types of administrators we say that we need. We don't have the administrators, we don't have the management. So we are working on many different fronts. It takes time, I hope, when I retire, and I don't know how long that will be, could be next week. When I retire, that there will be some measure of leadership that will have been contributed from the Health Ministry's department to the development of the work. Thank you all very much. Do we have time? I don't know how long this meeting is supposed to go on. And there's one at the back over there I see. Yeah.
Okay. We'll take these two questions.
And then a bit, yeah.
I wish I could remember the name of this country.
I'm looking forward to, I hear your voice. Oh, there you are, yes.
Yes, I wish I could remember the name of this country, but there's one in Africa that the government has taken this AIDS problem, taken the bull by the horns, and
Uganda.
They have... Uganda?
Yes, Uganda.
Okay, and the AIDS disease has tremendously dropped just through the abstinence. Now, one of my questions is, do we, in our health thing, have a health training program that would include that?
Do we ever, all right? We really do, yes. Uh-huh. And we've established an office in Africa to promote this. Dr. Oscar Giordano and his wife, Dr. Eugenia Giordano, are very much totally full-time engaged in this type of work. Yeah, but you have something more to say.
Yeah. Yes. When we were in the Middle East, my daughter was born in Baghdad, and the hospital was right there on the Tigris River. But they were offering the government was, providing the funds for a 100-year lease for the new hospital. And before we left there, that was under construction. And could you update me on what's happening in Baghdad?
Baghdad, we have a church. We don't have a hospital. We have a Seventh-day Adventist church. Unfortunately, it did receive some bombing with all this bombing activity that's going on. We still have about 100 members in Baghdad who worship every Sabbath. We don't have a hospital there at all. Maybe along similar lines, Loma Linda is working very closely in Afghanistan with the government and the medical school there, and they are working on, again, providing this capacity, the building of capacity, abilities in Afghanistan. And Loma Linda, with their team, Dick Hart, Lynn Behrens, Dom Zirkel, these people that are working out of Loma Linda have been doing a very, very valuable work. Perhaps the most important person there has been Dr. Hadley. 40 years ago, Dr. Hadley was out there, and
that was teaching pathology. As you know, he's worked in China. For 7 or 8 years, he helped promote Sir Runran Shaw. And then Afghanistan asked him to come back, and he's been going back there and teaching. Dr. Hadley's 84 years old, and a wonderful, wonderful missionary. There's an AIDS problem everywhere in the world, but it pains me to say that the Muslim world has less trouble with HIV/AIDS than does a Christian world. That is because they are stricter with their regulations and so forth. Now, we blame men in Africa. Very often we say it's a male problem. The Arab world is pretty tough males too, but they seem to have a less of a problem with HIV/AIDS. I do think, you know, when it comes to Africa, I'd like to say something like this, because I think people don't always understand Africa. We tend to think, oh, they must be an awfully promiscuous lot. That's not strictly true. When I was in South Africa many years ago, in the 50s and 60s, if you read in the newspapers, you would read that there were fights going on. They used to call them faction fights between Zulus or Xhosa, between Venda, between Malawians, and between the different people. They would have maybe 6,000 men working the mines, living in one hostel. Of course, they would form groups and fight each other. To keep them quiet, they provided beer gardens where there maybe was place for 3,000 men at any one time. You get 3,000 men together drinking, oh, only native beers. It was sort of some food value to them because they still had the grain in the beer, but had the alcohol too. You know, they would get a little merry and a little relaxed, and there would be the comfort suites around there. You know what I mean by the comfort suites? It would be the comfort ladies, those nubile young women coming in from the villages to service them. And of course, that was a tremendous way that a disease like AIDS would start to get spread, because you had people come from Malawi, from Zambia, from Angola. In those days, northern and southern Rhodesia, now Zambia and Zimbabwe, Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, all coming in to the mines, away for 6 months to a year, wives not allowed. What did we expect of secular people? Not Christian people, but secular people. And then those girls who made their money would go back from these camps back to their villages, a little bit of cash in their pockets, and a few viruses floating around in their blood, maybe hundreds and thousands of them. And so we see today the epidemic. In Uganda, it was the truck routes, same sort of thing on the truck routes. You know. So, big problems. I think North America is just as promiscuous. I think we've got treatment which lowers the viral load, so the infectivity is reduced here. If it weren't for that, I think we would be having an epidemic that was blowing our minds away. It's bad news. It's going to affect us all, sooner or later. Question over here.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still wondering about lessons learned, not Penang or Singapore. I don't know about those, but you referred to increasing capacity, and Pierre talked something about the selection process. Because of the awareness I have, and there's nothing peculiar, outstanding about this, that in a significant number of instances, the selection process for providing, or shall I say, of candidates to take the MPH from Loma Linda was, I don't know, similar or different, but the end result was the same. If the seminary wanted to offer a special program, there were a certain number of people who would be the recipients of that program. And if Loma Linda wanted to offer some program or other, then the same. I'm wondering if in the future you folks influence the selection process so that we have some more meaningful result in terms of increased capacity and likelihood of service and return for that investment? Thank you.
That question presupposes that we, whoever we may be, know who the best candidates are. And that would be extremely presumptuous of us to know who the best candidates were. And so this is always left to the field in which the degree is going to be given to select their candidates. We offer the degree, and we trust that the local field will provide the best candidates. Now, I can see from your body language that you don't believe the best candidates are selected. That's a problem for you to go back there and correct.
maybe you can indicate some awareness of the past practice in the past so that sensitizing them to the fact that you're aware of this might make you a little more cautious about doing it tomorrow. Because in the end, we are certainly short of, well, deceiving ourselves. We think we are deceiving the past.
Yeah. I think that if we were to move in the direction as we have, Southern Africa Indian Ocean Division and East Central Africa Division have both decided that they're going to try and see if they can develop a system for healthcare management. I think that once that comes about, we will, and this is no offense to any ministers here, but it will mean that we will be able to get some of the directors of those hospitals, some of the medical people to have a say in the development and operation of the medical systems. And if that takes place, then I hope that it would solve some of these problems of selection and retention of the appropriate people. I want to be clearly understood. In no way do I want a system that is not closely affiliated and on spiritual basis controlled by the church, but on the administration and the functioning as far as management to medical things, I would like to see a much greater input from those people who are directly involved and are in the know as to what needs to be done. So that's the direction we're moving in. Actually, we have a meeting. Dr. Behrens is going to go from Loma Linda University with me. We're going on the 28th of September through to the 28th of August through to the 9th of September. We will be meeting with both of those two divisions with this express view to see what kind of linkages will be beneficial, mutually beneficial for the advancement of the work and the building of systems in those two divisions. Pray for us. We'll need your prayers. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate what you've had to say and given us a lot of food for thought. Shall we stand and have a word of prayer as we dismiss? Dear Lord, we thank you for the opportunity to learn of the challenges and hopefully the solutions that are facing thy work. We ask that you will bless those who are dealing with these situations. Help us to be supportive and to contribute in ways that are constructive and helpful. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen.